This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and glad to have you with us. This is hour number two of the show. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about American history, specifically the history of the South. Since the Civil War, whites and blacks have struggled over the meaning of the Southern past. Various controversies involving things like the Confederate flag or renaming schools and streets are just the latest examples of this ongoing conflict. Our guest for this part of the show, Fitzhugh Brundage, who's professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, he says these battles are ultimately about who has the power to determine what we remember and who we will honor. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the ways that both blacks and whites have commemorated emancipation and the Civil War. It's a subject that he is very interested in, in fact, has authored a book on. The title is The Southern Past, A Clash of Race and Memory. It is published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press, and it's out now in the bookstores if you would like to take a look at it. Of course, as we talk here this morning with Fitzhugh Brundage, you should feel welcome to be a part of the conversation. The numbers here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. So that's for people who are listening to us here over the air right in the immediate area. But anybody else, if you're listening on the air in Illinois and Indiana, or if you happen to be listening on the Internet, you may use our toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Brundage, hello.
Good. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thanks very much for talking with us. We certainly appreciate it. I know that this is a you have written in the book that this is a particular interest of yours, competing black and white historical narratives and their fate in the public square, to put it in sort of a historical academic lingo.
Mm-hmm.
What interests you in that? Why is it that particular thing, this black and white historical memory in the South since the Civil War, why does that interest you so much?
Well, I think it began to interest me in the 1990s when there were a whole series of controversies that attracted a lot of attention in the press. And I was just interested in why these issues were arising when they did and why there was so much public attention paid to them. And some of the things that caught my attention, of course, the ongoing controversy over the Confederate battle flag. But there was, you may recall, and I believe it was 1994, Colonial Williamsburg in Williamsburg, Virginia, staged a recreation, a reenactment of a slave auction. And that aroused quite vigorous controversy. And there were just a series of events like that, and I was just curious as to why those events seemed to have such resonance for so many people. And it's not as though there hadn't been other historical controversies in the past, but for some reason, the topic of the Southern past seemed to have touched a nerve. So it was really contemporary events that attracted my attention to the topic. And then as I tried to understand why these controversies were arising in the 1990s and early 2000s, I necessarily, as a historian, went backwards.
Yeah. Well, I guess what strikes me as being an important thing to keep in mind is the extent to which historical memory is something that is deliberately constructed, mm-hmm. and is constantly being constructed and perhaps torn down and rebuilt, or by some people or by other people who are constantly making the efforts to shore it up, to maintain it as it was delivered to them, so that it's always something that seems open to question, under renovation, threatened. And in fact, I think you're right in the book that the very idea that the South is a place saturated in history is not an accident. It's the result of more than a century of very deliberate effort by people who saw themselves as Southerners, put that in quote, to construct.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. And I think that's another reason why it interests me is the reason the whole question of how various groups of people have remembered the past at different periods of history is such an important field of research and among contemporary historians. It's precisely this question of how it is that different groups of people tell their story through history. And in the case of the American South, I think it's particularly interesting that there are two communities in particular, and these are complex communities, so I don't want to overly simplify them, but white Southerners and black Southerners have lived together for centuries and have real intimacy on the one hand, and yet on the other hand, they have very, very different versions of history. But what has changed in recent years is that African Americans have been able, because of political power, growing economic influence, and other reasons, to tell their history in a way that whites can no longer ignore. And that dynamic, how it is that the history that blacks have told themselves has begun to enter the public space of the South, has begun to enter public life in the South, is what really interests me.
Yeah, and it seems that is an important change, because it seems to some extent still, but certainly for a long time, it seemed to be that when people talked about Southern history, Southern heritage, Southern culture, Southern whatever, Southern fill in the blank, that seemed to presuppose that what we were talking about was white.
Absolutely.
White history, white heritage, white culture.
Absolutely. And you'll even hear it, it comes up all the time, that sort of assumption, so that it's quite routine to hear someone say, well, the South lost the Civil War, or South Carolinians want the flag to fly because it's a flag of their heritage. Well, that's true for a part of South Carolina, but there's another part of South Carolina who may well look upon the Civil War as a victory. That, namely, African Americans in South Carolina may not look upon the Confederate battle flag the same way white South Carolinians do. But there is the presumption, as you say, when you say Southerners, we sort of think, oh, white Southern culture is what is being talked about.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Fitzhugh Brundage, he's professor of history at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's particularly interested in American history since the Civil War and has been doing a lot of research and writing on the subject of white and black historical memory in the South since the Civil War. And that is the subject of this book. I'll just mention again, it's titled The Southern Past, A Clash of Race and Memory. Belknap Press of Harvard University Press is the publisher. Questions, welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, you begin your writing here in this particular book in the late 19th century, here in a period where we're talking about, say, 30, 40 years, 50 years after the end of the Civil War, when mm-hmm. this was still something where people who had lived through it would still be around. There would still be Confederate veterans, and mm-hmm. there would be people who had been born slaves, people whose memory of this was very real. It's interesting that here, when you look at the efforts of white Southerners to construct this public memory of the past, that this was a particular preoccupation of women. Mm-hmm. It was women who took on this role of guardians of the past, and they were the ones who were organizing to put up monuments, and they held pageants, and they were concerned about the preservation of historical sites like Mount Vernon, to name one. Mm-hmm. Why particularly was it that women took on this mission and made this kind of preservation effort their goal?
You're certainly right, and I think it's one of the more fascinating dimensions of this. One thing that I should say is, women of all types of ethnicities and all across the United States tended to perform a similar function, to be concerned about how their community was represented. But I think in the case of the American South, there were a couple of things that may have intensified it. So it's perhaps a more exaggerated form of what was going on elsewhere. And I think the things that intensified it are quite understandable. One is, Of course, many white Southern women were related to men who had fought in the war, many of whom were maimed, some of whom had been killed or severely wounded. So there was a lot of personal tragedy, personal sense of personal loss that's fueling this. And understandably, an organization like the United Daughters of the Confederacy was deeply concerned with how the valor of white Southern men was being honored. But in addition to that, I think for a generation and for a couple generations of Southern white women, the Civil War had sort of dislocated Southern family life. It had obviously created a fair number, a substantial number of widows, but it also left a substantial number of women without any likelihood of marriage. And so to be a woman with sort of dislocated from traditional family life was profoundly unsettling. And so I think it was understandable that some women saw it as their mission to connect themselves to their family by serving as sort of preservers of family heritage and, by extension, the heritage of their region. And then finally, I think for many women, it was a mission that it was a project that they could undertake that enabled them to establish some sort of very, very important contribution to the project of white Southern life. And what I mean by that is, while men were rebuilding the New South and men were concerned with, shall we say, the economic reconstruction of the South, women were engaged in a cultural project of restoring, strengthening white Southern identity and testifying to its virtues. And by doing that, they could carve out a space, for a role for themselves in public life that otherwise was difficult for them to achieve at a time when they didn't have the right to vote, and white Southerners were deeply suspicious of any sort of radical reform. Mm-hmm. So I think that's one of the most interesting things to me about historical memory, is that people's motivations can never be reduced to just some sort of crass political aim, that it's white Southerners wanting simply to dominate African Americans. That was certainly part of what was going on. But there's also a powerful, powerful personal connection usually. And that's what enabled generations of white Southerners to be sustained in this effort of constantly reasserting the value of their past.
Mm-hmm. And just a moment here, I want to go on and talk a little bit about how black Southerners, what they were doing roughly in the same time. But before doing that, let me ask you, perhaps you could just talk a little bit about, if you look at what it was these women were doing and say what sort of events they wanted to commemorate or what sort of people they wanted to honor, what would those have been?
Well, predictably, they wanted to honor the heroes of the Confederacy, but not exclusively. There were many other Southern organizations, and sometimes they weren't just Southern. They could be national organizations in which Southern women participated when they were honoring revolutionary heroes. If there's a consistent theme, I think it would be the emphasis of white Southern women to demonstrate how rich Southern history was and how important the contributions of white Southerners had been to the nation. As you could imagine, after the Civil War and the catastrophic defeat of the Confederacy, some white Southerners were eager to assert that, of course, it was Southerners who had played a principal role in the creation of the American Republic to begin with. And so the Daughters of the American Revolution, the Colonial Dames, and other organizations were keen to dislodge the impression that somehow American history from the arrival of the Pilgrims up through the Civil War was really the story of the rise of the North and its contributions. So it ranged from everything, to give you tangible examples, everything from the preservation of historic homes associated with, say, Revolutionary War heroes, or for that matter, Confederate heroes, to deep concern about what was being taught about Southern history in public schools, to Confederate Memorial Day and the building of statues and monuments to all sorts of regional heroes. So in a to a remarkable extent, it was white Southern women who were responsible for building what I would call the commemorative landscape of the South that we still live in today.
Mm. And I suppose it's worth making the point that when we're talking about white Southern women here, we're not talking about just any women or all women. We're talking about a slice, and that would be those who were the most upper class women as well. The notions of class and perhaps also notions of preserving a class structure here mm-hmm. were part of this as well.
Certainly. This is predictably, and I think this is true in almost any society, the elites have the greatest stake in this whole debate, and so it was elite Southern women, although it's important to keep in mind that an organization like the United Daughters of the Confederacy reached into the middle class, and so it's larger than just a very small group of women, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Well, to turn a little bit to talking about what in roughly the same period African Americans in the South were doing, it seems that principally their means of expressing their history, their memory, was public celebrations and things organized around things like, unsurprisingly, things like the Emancipation Proclamation, the birthday of Abraham Lincoln, and apparently also, much to the chagrin of white Southerners, the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. African Americans really embraced celebrating the 4th of July, and there were very large, involved public displays that happened.
Absolutely, and I think it's very understandable why African Americans would have embraced large public ceremonies. One, they can be done without a very substantial amount of money to build a big monument. Some of the bigger Confederate monuments in the South cost many tens of thousands of dollars, and in a few instances, more than $100,000. African-American communities couldn't muster those kind of resources usually. So parades on Emancipation Day or festivities on the 4th of July were activities that could pull out the whole community and didn't cost that much money. And moreover, they offered an opportunity for oratory when black speakers could get up and talk about the Southern past and talk about the history of African Americans. And finally, the other reason that I think public ceremonies were very important to African Americans after slavery was as a way of demonstrating that African Americans were part of the public life of the South and that they wanted to be part of the public life and public rituals and that they would be. They would insist upon it. So, for example, during their Emancipation Day ceremonies, it was quite common to have parades that would make their way through the streets of whatever town or city the event was taking place. And they were usually very conspicuous in their use of major public spaces, whether they be in front of the Capitol in, say, Columbia, South Carolina, or a major business thoroughfare. And I think all of that was just to remind the white community that African Americans, too, had a history that they were very, very proud of.
And that I would expect, though, that there would be there now the potential for conflict involving that very use of the public space in that way.
There certainly were, and there are some occasions, some notable occasions, where there was serious conflict. In other instances, whites adopted a strategy, I would call it a sort of passive-aggressive strategy, which was either to literally withdraw and so not witness it. That was a typical strategy for white Southerners on the 4th of July, to literally abandon public spaces and withdraw into their households. And the same was true on January 1st, which was one of the most common days for Emancipation Day to be celebrated. Whites would just keep off the streets. But there were other instances where when white Southerners decided that enough was enough, and then they actively began to suppress black ceremonies. But I do want to emphasize there are other communities. I'll take one example, Norfolk, Virginia, which had an unbroken tradition of Emancipation Day celebrations, very, very large Emancipation Day ceremonies from the period of Reconstruction right on up into the 1930s. And white politicians allowed for those to happen, sometimes participated in the events. So there are a range of responses of white Southerners to these events, but you're certainly right that there were there were instances when violence broke out or there were active campaigns to suppress these events.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit before about the fact that there was this effort on the part of white Southerners, particularly white Southern women in the late 19th century to commemorate the South in the Civil War, and that there were a lot of monuments that were constructed to men who fought for the Confederacy. Interesting that also on the side of African Americans, black Southerners, that when they were doing their parallel kinds of celebrations or activities, that they also were very much involved and wanted to honor black soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And finding black men who had served in some kind of military capacity doing things for them was also very important to the African American community.
Absolutely, and that is one example of white reaction that it is very clear that it's white efforts to suppress this. As you mentioned, there were of course black veterans who had fought in the Union Army during the Civil War, tens of thousands of them in the American South. And they were always given a prominent place in any public ceremony, predictably enough. And when blacks celebrated Memorial Day in the South, which they did, they didn't celebrate Confederate Memorial Day. They celebrated the same Memorial Day that the North celebrated. Blacks always, of course, made a point of decorating the graves of black veterans and as well as having parades by black veterans. But after that generation, as that generation aged, really the only black military population in the South were state militias, and there were still black state militias into the late 19th century, but increasingly white politicians became more and more concerned about these militias, the idea of blacks being armed, being trained, and by the first decade of the 20th century, virtually all of those black militias had been abolished. And so for a period of time until World War I, there really, for a 15-year period there, black men could not demonstrate their sort of civic purpose. They couldn't participate in that major ritual of being a patriotic American, of being a member of the state militia, of parading on 4th of July or something like that. And so blacks were briefly shunted out of that whole possibility of civic expression. And so in that period of time, some of the black fraternal organizations sort of took up the slack and organized themselves into quasi-militias that had all the appearance and all the ceremony of militias, even though they weren't officially part of state militias. So the point being here that there really was a very, very rich tradition of celebration of black military prowess, even despite the efforts of white Southerners to stomp that out.
Mm. We are at our midpoint here. Let me introduce again our guest, Fitzhugh Brundage. He's professor of history at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also director of graduate studies. His interest is in American history since the Civil War and has been doing a lot of work on white and black historical memory in the South since the Civil War. And that is the subject of his book, The Southern Past, A Clash of Race and Memory, published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And questions welcome. We do have somebody here who would like to get into the conversation, and then certainly people who are listening are welcome. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the caller here is in Rankin on our line 4. Hello.
Yeah, hi, David. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. Very interesting show. Just a quick question, and I'll hang up and take it off the air. If I remember correctly, and I'm going back to the Ken Burns document, it seems to me, I recall that there was a fair amount of black soldiers, for some reason or another, maybe your guest can speak to this, that served in the Confederate Army. And I was just wondering if, in fact, that was the case, and if, in fact, that they were recognized, however they served for their military service for the Confederates. I just found that fascinating, and I wonder perhaps if your guest could speak to that. And I'll go ahead and hang up. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, I had some difficulty hearing that, but I think I heard the question. The question is about African Americans who may have served for the Confederate Army,
right,
and whether or not their participation was somehow recognized.
Right.
Well, that, needless, as you might imagine, this is an extremely contentious question, and it's complicated by what your definition of serving for the Confederacy entailed. There were tens of thousands. I don't know the exact number, and I'm not sure there would be any way of knowing the exact number. So there may well have even been more than tens of thousands, but many, many, many thousands of African American slaves who worked as slaves, building forts, doing all sorts of heavy labor for the Confederacy. They were not, how would I put this, they did not elect to do this work. They were enslaved, and they were taken by the Confederate Army to do this work, sometimes without the willing support of their slaveholder. So there were, in other words, very large numbers of slaves participating in the Confederate war effort. It gets trickier as to the question of whether or not African Americans ever fought, that is, actually took up arms, whether a slave or not, on behalf of the Confederacy. And that's a very disputed topic. What I can say about this that makes it interesting is that in the late 19th century, particularly at the very end of the century, around the turn of the 20th century, the Confederate organizations like the United Guards of the Confederacy and the United Confederate Veterans began to honor blacks who had been slaves to white Confederates and who had been at the front, whether as servants, as valets, servants for white Confederate soldiers, or in some other capacity. And they began to present them with various sorts of awards, sometimes even money, sort of so-called pension. There was talk of setting up pensions for some of the black slaves who had somehow been at the front, the Confederate front. So there was an effort to create, that is, in the late 19th century, to establish the notion that blacks had willingly fought for the Confederacy. I think it would be fair to say that there may have been some, but the numbers who willingly fought, took up arms on behalf of the Confederacy is very small. By way of contrast, there were 200,000 African Americans who left slavery, ran away, absconded, however, got out of slavery, and then fought for the Union. So I don't know. It's a tricky question to figure out how to answer because it is so contentious for reasons that can be easily imagined.
All right, let's go to another caller. This is someone in Champaign, and it's line number one.
I'd like to make a point, but before doing that, I think when I read The Killer Angels by Michael Shara, a wonderful objective account of the battle at Gettysburg, and I believe in that, in his book, some black men are fighting for the Confederacy. I'm not sure. In my own family, on my father's side, it would have been his grandfather's generation. There's a story of a man in his family who was quite young and went to fight, and a slave went with him and stayed with him throughout the war. And when he was killed in a battle, his name was Frank, and he brought this young man's body all the way back to South Georgia and somehow maneuvered a way to get a carriage or something to bring his body back in. I'd also like to say something in defense of the white Southerner, because I was born in Georgia and grew up mainly in the 40s. And I did attend in one town I lived in near Atlanta, which I call my hometown. We moved around a lot because my father was a Methodist minister. But in this town, a wonderful woman named Miss Sally Fanny Gleaton, who was active in women's suffrage, was jailed with Catherine Hepburn's parents, was a remarkable can-do type woman. And she directed our Children's of the Confederacy meetings. In those meetings, there was nothing racist ever said. We merely answered with the name, serial number, rank, and if we knew it, the battles that our ancestors had fought in. And once a year, there was a service on Confederate Memorial Day, and it was held in the public school I attended. And the woman who was usually in charge of the program was a descendant of Jefferson Davis. And there was, it was more or less like a history lesson. No indoctrination, as far as I know of. And the other kids envied us. I was middle class. I certainly was not upper class. And the other kids who weren't members of that group envied us because we had the whole day off from school after that ceremony. And we went out to the two cemeteries in that town and put flags on the graves of the Confederate soldiers who were buried there. But it, like I say, it was more or less from a historical viewpoint. And when I studied history in high school, American history, everybody had a chance to in our class to tell a story of Civil War times or whatever, and everybody in the class except one did have a story. And he had moved; his family had moved to the South later, but he told an interesting Depression story. And I think, I look at it as mainly a love of history because a lot of Southerners I know and in my own family really liked history. Not only, going way back, Romans, Greeks, the whole thing. So I'll just leave it there.
All right. Well, I don't know, Professor Brennan, do you want to react to that?
Well, I think the caller makes a point that I agree with, and I certainly hope earlier I conveyed this, that the motivations of people to remember their past are very complicated, and they don't. Sometimes they can be sinister, and sometimes they are quite sinister. But by no means do I want to sound like I'm implying that's the principal motivation for example, for all white Southerners all the time. The personal connection that she described was hugely important, and could motivate people to remember history in a very, very personal way. It's entirely understandable. People went to, laid their lives on the line during the Civil War, and it's understandable that their descendants would be keen on recognizing that sacrifice. So her experience is very interesting, and I think probably resonates with many other listeners. At the same time, what is striking is that in the context of the South, the history that would have been taught at the school that she attended and the history that might have been taught if there was a black high school in her community would have been different, understandably so. And the striking thing, I guess the point that I want to come back to is that those two histories were very seldom talked about or acknowledged. Black Southerners knew what white Southerners said about the past because they heard it all the time and moved through a landscape filled with how white Southerners thought about their past. But white Southerners had very little occasion to come into contact with the history that black Southerners held as their own.
So there are two things that are going on here. There is, on the one hand, what is being said and what is being taught, and on the other, what is not.
Yes.
The big pieces that are perhaps being conveniently ignored or glossed over, or people say, oh, yes, well, we know all about that, and that was bad, but that was the past, and when we're talking about something like slavery, for example.
Right. Or, well, I mean, we do this, too. It's you know, I would imagine if I was a high school teacher right now and I was trying to figure out how to deal, when I got in my high school history class, to the election, to the 2000 presidential election, I would think, oh, I'm not sure exactly how I want to deal with this issue. This could open up a whole can of worms, and it depends on the class and your students, but there are all sorts of issues where we dance around that some are obviously extremely charged, and yes, certainly white Southerners, like every group of people, were making decisions about what they didn't want to talk about. And black Southerners had a harder time having any control over what they could and couldn't talk about in public spaces because they didn't have the kind of power, the authority that white Southerners had.
Well, I have a couple of people here, and I get right to them. But just let me ask for a moment or go on here to the next part of the story that gets us into the 20th century. I think one of the big changes that happened was we go from a period where a lot of the efforts at commemoration were, in a sense, private, or at least they were private. They were done with private money.
Mm-hmm.
Once we get into the 20th century, here's the period where we see the creations of a lot of archives and museums, things mm-hmm. like that. There was a great growth in these kind of institutions that were paid for with public funds. There was this argument made for putting state funds into these sorts of things. And I guess the question that I particularly am interested in is, when you look at those kinds of things, and certainly not every state did this, and not every state put a lot of money in. Some did, some didn't. But if you look at these kinds of things, creation of archives, museums, things that had this kind of preservation and educational function, to what extent, if any, did they document the experiences of African Americans?
They didn't to any great extent, and to the extent that they did, it was often, so to speak, unintentionally. For example, many of the early archives in the South really blossomed in the early 20th century, the first two decades of the 20th century, before World War II is when they really take off. And many of the great collections, for example, there's a very noted collection here at the University of North Carolina. For example, LSU has some really extraordinary collections. Those collections are often the papers of very, very prominent Southern slaveholding families. Understandable and appropriate. These are wonderful collections, and they are the foundation for what we know about slavery. Well, they're filled with information about African Americans, but it's, of course, information for African Americans through the eyes of people who owned them. And as far as sources written by African Americans or sources directly relevant to African American life, many collections founded during this period of time were extremely thin, and they made very little effort to collect that material. Again, it's understandable. I'm not trying to suggest some profoundly sinister motive here. There wasn't an effort to suppress that history. That's just not what they did. They collected the papers and the artifacts and the material culture of elite white Southerners. And so your point there about the public funding of these is what I think is really a crucial thing about the debate, a crucial element of the debate, the contest over the Southern past during the 20th century. Once public money was being spent on Southern history, then once African Americans had some sort of political power, it was just a matter of time before they would say, well, we want some of that money spent on our history. And that is eventually what happened in the 1970s and 80s.
We have about 10 minutes left, maybe a little bit more in this part of the show. I'll get some more callers in here in just a moment. Our guest is Fitzhugh Brundage. He's professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. He is the author of the book, The Southern Past, A Clash of Race and Memory, published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. He's particularly interested in white and black historical memory in the South since the Civil War, and that's what this book is about. Let's talk with some other people who are listening, and we'll go next to Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. I just want to make a comment about Chapel Hill. I went to graduate school there. Beautiful place. You're a lucky man. The only thing that jarred my mind in the last few minutes, in a sense, doesn't sit on how this was done, was the blacks owning guns, and I presume we're talking rifles and handguns. Since I know next to nothing about the laws then about ownership of firearms, I was wondering if you could talk to that, how they actually got them and could keep them without blacks, you know, about the whites taking them away from them, if you could make some comment about that. Thanks a lot.
Sure. Well, there, after the Civil War, once Reconstruction sort of established that blacks had approximately the same rights of citizenship that whites had, blacks were gun owners just like whites. What was terrifying to white Southern politicians in particular, about black militias was the idea that these were men who were being trained in how to use rifles very effectively. That is, they were being trained in target practice and maneuvers, etc. That's what really scared them. As far as I know, I'm unaware of any serious effort to restrict black gun ownership in the late 19th century. That was more or less just assumed blacks would have access to guns like white people did. So the individual black gun owner wasn't, I mean, that, of course, that might have scared some white Southerners, but it's really the idea of organized black men marching about with the same military training that white men had. That's what they didn't want.
All right, let's talk with someone in Muhammad on cell phone, line one. Hello.
Hi. I'd appreciate it if you'd make a comment on more recent events. I'm thinking particularly of Andrew Young just stepping down from a commission after making definitely anti-Semitic and anti-Korean remarks, and Jesse Jackson referring to New Yorkers as or New York as Jaime Town. And as you said, the blacks are very interested in celebrating what blacks did. And, of course, the whites in the South were celebrating what the whites did. That was their heritage. What's going on today in black schools or schools with predominantly black students? Are they being educated into what, for example, the huge Jewish influence on the civil rights movement, which to some extent never would have happened without the Jewish community actively going down there and recruiting? And we know about the three young men, one black, two Jewish boys, who were killed. It seems to me that when you have the educated leaders of the black community making comments which are anti any other group, that there's something very wrong, and it looks like it's not being addressed in the schools, but I don't know because I don't go to a black school. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well,
thank you.
I will just offer a brief observation. I'm not sure I'm really qualified to talk about what is being taught in any given history class in public schools, whether they be for African-Americans or not. But what I can say is I think the issue you raise is an interesting one about what is being taught now. In the American South, one of the amazing things that's happened in many areas is after the schools were desegregated, legally desegregated, they've now effectively become de facto resegregated. And extreme examples are in Mississippi, a few parts of Georgia, where schools are now essentially public schools are over almost totally African American or Hispanic, and private schools, typically private Christian academies, are overwhelmingly white. What's going on in those schools, I assume, is the same curriculum that's being taught throughout the state. And I think the point that you raise, I would say the biggest challenge is probably the standards-based testing that's being done now, the big effort on standardized tests, because from the history teachers I know teaching in public schools, they all lament that they now have to teach to the standards, and they don't have time to deal with the complexities of history. And so if it isn't on the test, they're not going to talk about it. So my guess is rather than students learning whatever attitudes they may have in their high school history classes, they are not being those attitudes are coming in before they ever get into high school history classes, and then they're not being addressed because teachers don't have time to do it as they teach to the test. But that's, you raise an interesting question, and I'm just not sure I'm qualified to answer it.
Well, in the time that we have remaining, we have maybe 3-4 minutes left, but we have been talking about, in almost all the conversation here, we've been talking about the pre-civil rights era.
Right.
So we should at least round it out a little bit and talk about what has happened since, particularly once we get into the period of time when African Americans are in a position to press for acknowledgement of their history as well, and where here it's going to be a much more open and potentially difficult kind of struggle in if we have two competing visions between the two competing visions and between the two communities.
Well, and that's in a way I think the big question about what's going to happen in the South, and perhaps in some ways a larger question about, if you put these questions into the context of American society as a whole, I think I was very pessimistic when I started research on this, and that was longer ago than I care to remember. I was very pessimistic about, I thought, the capacity of the South to deal with black and white memory in a way that was productive. But I was surprised, and some people may call me Pollyannish, but I've actually been surprised by how much distance the South has covered in the last 15 years. However, having said that, I think what may be emerging is essentially a tolerance for these two different interpretations of Southern past, some sort of recognition that they exist, but very little effort to, shall we say, get them to speak to each other, to integrate them, so that black Southerners will have their history, white Southerners will have their history, but the two never really come together, and it's easy to go to historical sites and avoid whichever version of history you're not particularly interested in. So we now have African-American heritage tours. Most of the people who take those tours are African-Americans or whites from outside the region. We have the more traditional Southern history tours that may not address any of the issues that are dealt with on the African-American heritage tours. And so, in other words, they're going to leave you with whatever sort of historical experience you want. If you want to ignore the other, you can, which, I mean, maybe that's the best we can imagine. But I think that it is quite possible that that is the future of this, as opposed to any sort of strenuous debate or resolution of the controversies between them.
Something that I do think is really interesting, and again, we really don't have time to go into it, I think it would be worth an entire book, I expect, is the extent to which various competing versions of the history are things that have been constructed to be sold to tourists.
Oh, certainly. And in the American South, tourism's big business virtually everywhere, but in many parts of the South, if it wasn't for tourism, there wouldn't be a whole lot else that could be exploited. So it's very important. And then the South also, like the American West, is blessed with having a very, very deeply rooted image that's in the popular imagination. And that's an image that produces all sorts of problems if you want to tell the more complicated history of the region with any breadth.
Yeah, and just as you comment on it in the conclusion of the book, also I'm sure that as you say, the South is changing. It's like the entire country is changing. I'm sure there are people who are concerned that if there is some sort of unique Southern identity, that it's being lost, that it's being diluted, as the country seems to become more sort of the same wherever you go, and the South, like other parts of the country, are experiencing demographic changes that changes the nature of the country. So all of that, I'm sure those are powerful forces that are at play too.
Well, and there's one sort of simple way to get across how dramatic some of these could be. There's a community just south of Chapel Hill called Siler City, which was a chicken processing community. It was a major industry there. And as of 10 years ago, it was overwhelmingly, almost entirely native-born Southern and large majority white Southern community. It is now 60% Hispanic. and it's overwhelmingly populated by Mexican immigrants and Guatemalan immigrants. And yet, I honestly don't remember the name of the high school there, but I would not be surprised if the public high school in Siler City is named something like Robert E. Lee High, and that the overwhelming majority of students are either foreign-born or first-generation Hispanic-American and African-American. And one has to imagine that that's going to create some interesting, sort of dimensions to what it means when the Robert E. Lee Rebels go out on the football field.
Well, at that, we'll have to finish. If you're interested in reading some more on the subject, you can look for this book that we have been talking about. The title is The Southern Past, A Clash of Race and Memory, published by Belknap Press of Harvard University Press. And our guest, Fitzhugh Brundage, he's the author. He's professor of history at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Professor Brundage, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.